What shall I say first? What shall I keep until the end? The gods have tried me in a thousand ways. I am Laertes' son, Odysseus. My home is on the peaked sea mark of Ithaca, a rocky isle, but good for a boy's training. I shall not see on earth a place more dear, though I have been detained in the smooth caves of Calypso and in the halls of Circe the Enchantress. Where shall a man find sweetness to surpass his own home and his parents? In far lands he shall not, though he find a house of gold.
That's Odysseus speaking in a modern adaptation of Homer's epic. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Homer's Odyssey has captivated our imagination for nearly 3,000 years. Odysseus has been away for 10 years fighting in the Trojan War, and now he takes another 10 years to get home to Ithaca, his faithful wife Penelope, and his son Telemachus. Along the way, he runs into a whole series of symbolic obstacles and adventures. Tony Award-winning playwright Mary Zimmerman recently adapted the Odyssey for the stage, adding modern dimensions to it. Joining us to explore the upcoming University Theater production of Mary Zimmerman's Odyssey, which opens in Madison on Friday, November 7th and runs through November 16th, are Heather Pickering, director, Lee Chow-Ping, choreographer, Kaylin Fleck, playing the part of Odysseus, and Christian Inouye, composer and actor playing the part of Telemachus. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is one of the most famous texts of all time. You know, definitely a classic. I think it's billed as the greatest adventure ever, the biggest journey, and so on. Why take the Odyssey and sort of retell it on stage? Why work with this myth, do you think, now?
Well, I think that this myth, I don't consider it to be an old myth. It's a myth that still exists. The structure that was used to write the Odyssey is a structure that has been used by almost every single person who's ever told a creation story throughout time. It's a structure that's been used to tell almost every adventure story, movie that's ever been written. So even though this tale is, in fact, about 2,700 years old, it is not an ancient story. We were given a fantastic formula to use with this particular piece, and it has subsequently become the formula that everybody has used throughout time to tell any kind of adventure. It's in the archetypal characters that we have within the piece, everything from our traveler who is seeking out something more, and we have a coming-of-age story with a young man who needs to go out and find his story in the world and make his own in order to return back home. So it's
you
not
got
an old story.
A marriage that can't survive a long-distance relationship. Mm-hmm. You've got all kinds of obstacles and pitfalls that happen. What about the Mary Zimmerman version of the Odyssey made it seem to you something that you wanted to do here in Madison? Tell us about Mary Zimmerman and about this particular version.
Well, sure. Originally, it is an epic piece. In the case of Mary Zimmerman, she's taken it and turned it into a narrative piece. And she's taken the narrative and she's putting it into the mouths of Odysseus and Athena. And these two characters together switch off and on as narrators for this particular production. The other thing that makes this production a little bit different is that it actually starts with a modern day woman who is desperately trying to find access to this old story. And eventually she wakes up the muses somewhat unintentionally, and this muse comes forward and grabs her and possesses her. And it is in that moment that this woman is transported into the story and is transformed by the cast into Athena. And now this modern day woman helps tell this narrative. And throughout the entire evening, we see little anachronistic touches throughout the show. And we never quite forget that we are still seeing a show that is coming from a slightly modern perspective.
I think I haven't seen your production, but in reading the script, it has, when the modern woman is trying to read Homer, It has the muse come and toss the book out of her hands. Is that what you're doing too?
Yes, that's exactly what we're doing. And actually, Chaoping can help me out here a little bit. Yes, in our version, the muse does come forward, just like Mary wrote it. And she grabs the book, throws it over her shoulder, hits the floor. And then that book is kind of acting as a magnet of sorts that draws forth all the other players for the evening, who in turn bring a copy of the Odyssey on stage. And our woman travels through a series of books as pseudo stepping stones.
Right. We had the idea of bringing her into the story physically by walking, by each character bringing the story to her in a way, bringing to life the story. So she'll walk through the books, on the books.
I was thinking of how when I teach my literature students, I always say I want the literature to jump off the page and into their lives. And this seems like a pretty
It's kind of that idea.
Yes,
it's kind of that idea played out.
Could you argue sort of that one of the problems, though, of taking the epic poem by Homer, which would, I've heard, take almost 20 hours if you heard it read all the way through, that if you take it and turn it into a few hours of a play, are you creating a kind of almost Cliff Notes version in doing so, you know, making some cuts and making it palatable in a way that, is it saying that we can't handle the whole Homer epic?
Well, it's funny you say that because I think Mary Zimmerman herself really struggled with that. The first version that she wrote was actually two nights long. So the audience came, saw the first half night one, and second night they had to come back to see the rest of it. And she eventually distilled it down to 3 hours and 20 minutes herself. And I know that that was a struggle that she herself went through. But one of the things that she was really searching for is how can I make these people that are relatable to a modern day audience? So the story is definitely still there and intact, and she's translated, using the translations by Fitzgerald to bring this particular piece to life. And for the most part, the language that was used in the Fitzgerald version is still intact in this particular piece. She sticks very close to much of the original language used until we, of course, reach the moment where the sirens come in. And that is one of the only spots in the show that Mary has put her own information into the production.
And I look forward to talking about that a little later.
That, you know, the idea is that this production is not replacing the text at all. You know, the text is the text. This is a staging, and this is a you know, theatrical production. And so it will be its own thing, which does through its, you know, visual effects, through its language, through its music, you know, all together creates, you know, this Gesamtkunstwerk, you know, of experience, so that you can take away some of the essential parts of the story still without all of the length.
I know that it's difficult on radio to talk about dance. A little easier to talk about music because we can hear it. But with your role as choreographer, can you just give us a little sense of why that element of dance is brought in to a staging of the Odyssey and what kinds of things audiences would see if they come to the production?
Well, Heather and I have worked very closely talking through the you know, Mary Zimmerman's interpretation of this classic. And it's a very physical production. And I think through that language, this other language, is how we can help to keep telling the story, you know, keep moving it along in a different way, show different ways that characters are relating to one another. How do they feel about each other? Who is this person? You know, something about their character. We're getting a lot of that physically without having to say it in words, without having to spell it out. So it also... It is part of the fact that it is this sort of modernized, you know, sort of contemporary version. And we will find, I think, you know, maybe less literal, more abstract ways to, just to describe, let's say, a death or a slaughter or, you know, some of the other things that are happening in the story.
So a slaughter dance?
Well,
explain.
Yeah.
What would we see for a slaughter dance?
Well, we kind of did a couple of different things. I mean, well, one thing about Mary Zimmerman is adding movement into her pieces is just another one of her hallmarks. It's in almost every one of her productions, which is one of the reasons why she's so exciting. I think movement can often tell a story where words are not necessarily always needed to complete it. In our case, the suitors, when they pass away in this particular production, pass away, that was a little nice, when they are slaughtered, what happens in this particular version is a light, a special light pops up on stage. And in that light, we see one suitor standing there. And in our version, we have Athena sitting in the background with a big ball of red twine and a pair of scissors. And she pulls up a string and she cuts it off. And when she does so, either Eumaeus or Telemachus or Odysseus comes forward to that particular suitor in the light. And this long red rope drops down from the ceiling. And that rope is then tugged down and falls down and collapses around the suitor. And the suitor then collapses down to the floor with his red rope. After all of the suitors and consequently a maid are slaughtered by the men who are taking their house back, Hermes comes up from the underworld and all of the dead suitors rise up, grab onto their little lifeline and drag their lifelines down into the underworld with Hermes. So that's an example of how we are taking the suitors out. In the original version, the story, not Mary's, but there's 120 suitors that are brutally slaughtered. And of course, our version doesn't necessarily have
that many.
No, many we corpses. Don't have 120 suitors on stage, and we certainly don't have anything as tangible as blood going everywhere. It's a much more of a metaphorical death.
Well, let's talk about the music, too.
I understand, Christian, that you're playing a double role as actor and also composing some music. What sort of, we heard a little bit of music with the opening. Can you give us one sample that we might listen to of some of the music that comes into the show and how you went about matching that to what was happening in the play?
Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting moments throughout the show, and there's a lot of varying sections of music, but that also fit the varying sections of worlds and different kind of gods and goddesses that we encounter throughout the play. But I really want to try to match a theme to Odysseus and have a really great theme for him. So that main theme is going to be one that goes throughout, and you can hear that throughout the entire show.
I get a sense of boldness from that music. Tell me kind of what went into that, what elements. We hear some voices. We hear a definite, strong beat. What was in your head?
Yeah, Mary has written in the script a lot of drums and a lot of rhythm, so I wanted there to be some rhythmic elements throughout the show. So there's a lot of different percussive elements in that song you heard. Cello and piano are the instruments that are paired with Odysseus's character. And there's also a lot of choral bits. There's section two, actually, in the show where there's choral elements that were on stage singing. And that's also reflected in the music and the tracks that will play along with the actors on stage, too.
Well, let's talk about the character of Odysseus that music is sort of representing. And I guess I would ask you, Kaylin, what is your conception of Odysseus? How do you see this man that you're playing? It's a big role.
Yeah. It's huge, and it's something that I'm still discovering new things about. The thing that really draws me to the character is kind of the beaten down, downtrodden traveler who's just trying to get home to his wife, to his son. That's the part that I personally connect to, and it's the other aspects that I'm finding it to be a fun challenge to try and discover the fact that there is this kind of this wit to the character. He's almost a trickster character, mm-hmm. as well as being a hero. there is a largeness to the character, and more than just physical largeness. His personality is large. He's a storyteller, which is something that was very, very important in this world, that you go and visit people. The thing that they want to hear from you is your stories, especially if you happen to be a war hero, which is something that I don't relate to at all. So that's another aspect that I try to, you know, how can I connect to this? And I find myself going to other archetypal characters to try and find access into that. What other characters do I know of, either from classical myth or even modern myth, that I can grasp onto? I find myself walking into rehearsals humming and singing music from The Lord of the Rings a lot, because that happens to be a modern myth that many of us have become familiar with, either through the books or through the movies. For me, the music helps me really connect to that, and Christian's music really helps me to connect to the character as well.
Is there a passage you might read that you particularly enjoy doing as part of this play?
The passage that I read earlier is
okay.
is one that I certainly connect to a lot. It's difficult to pinpoint exactly like a specific scene, but I know that the scene with the Cyclops is one that is very familiar to a lot of people, and it's one that I'm having a lot of fun trying to connect with.
Well, before we hear it, let's set that up for people who have forgotten their Odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you could do this, Heather. Just describe for us where we are in Odysseus' journey, what the Cyclops looks like, and what we're about to hear.
Great. The Cyclops is a large, one-eyed brute who lives on his own island. And on that island, he has his cave. He also takes care of a flock of sheep. And every single night, he returns to the cave with his flock of sheep. Odysseus and his men pull up to this particular island on their adventure. This is fairly early on in the adventure, but this is a pivotal scene, because this is the scene where our lovely Odysseus gets himself in trouble and for 20 more years is unable to go home.
And don't forget his relationship. I mean, who he's related to.
Oh, right. Yes. Cyclops' father happens to be Poseidon, the lord of the sea, lord of the ocean. So what happens is our dear Odysseus unloads from the ship, has a feeling about the island, thinks a little bit in advance, and pulls some wine from the ship to offer whomever he thinks he might encounter when he's down the island. They go exploring on the island, find the cave. They walk into the cave. They see cheeses everywhere, sheep everywhere. They say, oh, quick, let's just take some sheep and some cheese and go load it back up on the ship. And Odysseus says, no, I think we should wait. I want to meet the person who lives here. Well, it turns out it is this large, one-eyed brute who comes into the cave, rolls the boulder over the mouth of the cave, so these poor men are now trapped inside. And as it turns out, he has an affinity for eating men, and proceeds to then pull some...
Thanks for putting that delicately.
No, you're welcome. And he proceeds to eat several of the sailors that are within this particular group. He goes out the next morning to tend his flock. The men find an olive branch in the back corner of the cave underneath all the sheep dung. They take it out and they put it in the fire and they turn it. They sharpen that particular piece. And their entire plan is to poke out the Cyclops' eye and then escape. But of course, they have to be a little creative about it. They have to make sure they don't get trapped in the cave with the Cyclops when they poke his eye out. So even though the men want to go hastily into that, Odysseus pulls them back. So in this particular moment, the Cyclops has returned home. He's already eaten two of the men earlier on in the day. Odysseus offers the man some wine. He drinks some wine. He gets a little drunk. He eats a couple more men. And then he asks Odysseus what his name is.
Let's hear this.
Cyclops, try some wine. Here's liquor to wash down your scraps of men. Taste it and see the kind of drink we carry under our planks. I meant it for an offering if you would help us home.
Give me another, thank you kindly. Tell me, how are you called? I'll make a gift will please you.
Cyclops, you ask my honorable name? Remember the gift you promised me, and I shall tell you. My name is Nobody. Mother, father, and friends... Everyone calls me Nobody.
Nobody. Here's your gift. I'll eat you last after all your friends.
Men, this is our chance. May the gods help us.
Forward they sprinted, lifted the olive branch, and rammed it deep in his crater eye. Eyelids and lash were seared, the pierced ball hissed, and the roots popped.
Cyclops! Cyclops! Help me! Help!
What ails you, Polymephus? Why do you cry so sore in the starry night, depriving us of sleep?
Is a robber stealing away your sheep? Is somebody trying to kill you or ruin you?
Nobody! Nobody tricked me! Nobody's ruined me!
Ah, well, if nobody has played you foul, there in your lonely bed, you must be sick.
But nobody!
Sickness comes from Zeus and can't be helped.
Pray to your father, Lord Poseidon.
Odysseus was filled with laughter to see how like a charm the trick had worked.
That's great. So this trick where he gets him to say nobody, that he thinks it's the name nobody, is right. It's a real joke there, and it works. Mm-hmm. So this goes along with your idea of Odysseus being this great trickster who's using his wit against
it's,
this.
Mm-hmm. It's almost a replay of Abbott and Costello.
But from so long
But except
ago.
For before. Right.
That's right. We're going to look more at Mary Zimmerman's retelling on stage of the Odyssey when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
They are lords of all the other islands, here courting my mother. They use our house as if it were a house to plunder. My mother hates them all, but we don't dare turn them away. We are too far outnumbered. Here is my forecast. They will destroy everything we have, and as soon as they can, they will kill me, and one of them will take my mother.
Perhaps it is well that Odysseus is delayed. His heart would break to hear you speak like this.
He's gone, my friend. The whirlwinds have him.
If I were you, I'd take steps to make these men disappear.
Take steps? I haven't.
At daybreak, call the islanders to assembly. The suitors must go scattering to their homes. Then there's the course for you. If you agree, get a sound ship afloat with 20 oars and go abroad for news of your father. Go ask King Menelaus and his wife Helen of Troy. They are both now back at home.
But I don't even know what...
If you should learn your father is alive and coming home, you could hold out another year. But if you learn that he is dead and gone, come home and raise a mound for him, burn his gear, and give your mother to another man. Then decide how to avenge yourself on all of these, how you should kill them, outright or with guile.
I don't know. I've never been something like this before.
That's a scene between Athena and Telemachus in Mary Zimmerman's retelling of the Odyssey. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with University of the Air, and we have the director, choreographer, composer, and some actors from the University Theater production of the Odyssey. Tell us about that scene where it seems this young son who just wanted a normal father is being goaded into action.
Well, Athena has actually come in disguise. She's gone to Zeus. She's gotten permission to bring Odysseus home and also to help Telemachus find his way. So she's come in disguise to the home of Telemachus and Penelope, and she is the one that grabs a hold of Telemachus and plants some ideas in his head that what he needs to do is go out, find information about Dad. If Dad is still alive, then you need to continue to wait. If he's not alive, then let's go ahead and come home, have a memorial for Dad, and give your mother away to another man. And it is in this scene that Telemachus is told, you are no longer of an age to remain young. You must grow up. You must go out and move forward.
Christian, how do you see this character, Telemachus?
He has an interesting arc. In the beginning, we see him, and he's very, very weak. He's very, very unable to control his house and everything going on there, and he really needs Athena to really spur him on towards adulthood. And so it's an interesting arc throughout the show to see him change from that really weak kind of boy into a strong man trying to support his father.
How do you make a modern connection to this idea that you've got all these suitors that are just hanging out in the house, eating and taking advantage of the household and kind of predators on Penelope? What's the sort of modern connection there that you can make?
Well, it's hard because in Greek society, there's a rule, which is if any man comes to your doorstep and asks to be taken in, you take him or her in because they could, in fact, be a god in disguise. So the Greek culture is just one of the most welcoming cultures on earth, because if you turn them away and it turns out they were a god in disguise, then wrath will descend upon your house. So technically, Telemachus and Penelope have allowed all of these men to come into their home because that is what you do. And these men have stayed there and they've plundered this home and they've, you know, pillaged the home. They've eaten all of his food. They've drank all of his wine. They've abused the women in the house. And I don't know that there's necessarily, I'm searching here for a modern day connection to that, but the practice of hospitality is still something that's very much so alive within the Greek culture.
We also see Penelope able to trick the men with her loom idea. So just the way we saw Odysseus use his wit to conquer the Cyclops, we see Penelope being pretty smart herself, right?
She is. They're an equally matched couple on an intellectual level. She spends every single day weaving a shroud for Odysseus's father, and she keeps telling the men, I can't be with anybody until I finish weaving this particular piece. She spends all day weaving it, and at night when everybody goes to sleep, she undoes it so that it never moves forward. However, one day, one of those maids that loves to cavort with the suitors comes in and catches her in action and quickly tells the suitors. And so things have turned awry, but for several years, she got away with weaving by day and unweaving by night.
Although you've got positive characters, female characters like Penelope and obviously the goddess Athena, most of the women that seem to come in and out of this story are pretty demonic, pretty destructive. Tell us about Calypso.
Calypso is actually the woman that has been holding Odysseus on an island for over 10 years. And she is the very first person that Athena must go to, or that they send news to Calypso and tell her, Zeus has commanded, you must let this man go. And Calypso in our version is kind of like a young girl who tends to collect anything that washes up on her shore. She's on this island. She can't leave the island. And everything that washes up is a sweet little treasure that she holds on to. And when you first see Odysseus, he is actually tethered to her on the island. She has a line that runs between the two of them to keep a hold of him.
In terms of movement, how do you show the difference between a god and goddess and then the mortals? I mean, are there different ways that they move? So that if we see Zeus up in the sky, or we see Athena when she's acting as Athena versus pretending to be someone else, are we able to see the difference?
To some extent, yes, because we do, one thing that is built into our set is we do have a higher point in which we see many of the gods up on this higher point. But Athena also flies, quote marks around that, in our production in a very unique way.
Right. So we'll use, you know, different dance ways to, don't want to give it all away, but, you know, we'll let her fly in a dancing way. and, you know, so I don't know if the distinction's so clear, except that yes, there will be, you know, some height, you know, sort of power play ways that it's staged, who's up, who's down, who's over here. You know, the tethering is really interesting, of course, because they will be actually tied by rope to one another, Calypso and Odysseus.
So what does that rope look like? He's on a leash, or
kind of. It's in a way, I mean, there's so many allusions, you know, of what that means, you know, to be basically chained to another person for him to not be able to leave. So there's a lot that we can do in terms of, you know, even once he's released from that, while he has permission basically to create and build his ship so he can set sail, there's a lot that we're going to do to show her support and also sort of lack of support for the fact that she doesn't really want her lover to leave.
Mm-hmm. There's a moment in the play, and I'm forgetting exactly where it becomes clear that the gods get away with kind of not so godly behavior and then are judgmental of human beings when they have flaws. That whole, and you were mentioning about how gods sometimes could show up at your door disguised as human. It's a blurry line between mortal and divine. Tell us about that.
It is. It's not only a blurry line between mortal and divine, but even between men and women. The whole society that is in this particular piece is a very patriarchal society. And it is the men are those that benefit, and the women are either viewed as witches or temptresses or unhuman monsters. And it isn't the only women that are true women in this particular piece are the women that are at home and waiting for Odysseus to return. So there is a definite way in which women are portrayed in this particular piece. And even then, there's a sexual and moral standard that is run for the men and women in this particular piece. For example, Odysseus is allowed to encounter many a woman on his way back home to Penelope. However, Penelope stays chaste for 20 years waiting for this man. Had she not done so, the end of the story would have come about in a very different way. But Calypso actually has the ability in her scene to confront Hermes about the double standard that is allowed between men and women.
Let's hear a little of that.
You have to let him go and give him transport.
What monsters you are!
Excuse me?
You gods who live up in the sky! You can't bear to see a goddess sleeping with a man, even if she lives in the middle of the ocean and has no one else for company! You're pretty slack yourselves with earthy girls, but when it comes to us...
Calypso.
So now you grudge me, too, my mortal friend? But it was I who saved him when all his troops were lost. His good companions, the wind and current, washed him here to me. I fed him, loved him, sang that he should not die nor grow old ever in all the days to come. But now there's no eluding Zeus's will if he insists.
He does insist.
But surely I cannot send him. I have no long-oared ships, no company to pull him on the broad back of the sea. I live alone.
He is to build his own ship, and you're to help.
All right, I'll let him go. I'll help him build a ship. Go on. Get out of here. You've given me your message. Go on.
Then let's hear a little bit where Odysseus comes in to the scene.
Unhappy friend, come here.
Calypso, please.
It's not for that, Odysseus. I don't want anything from you, Odysseus. Your unhappiness has just ended. You're going home.
Don't tease me, sweet Calypso.
You're going home. No need to grieve, no need to feel your life consumed here. I have pondered it, and I shall help you go. Come and cut down high timbers for a raft so you can ride her on the misty sea. Come, I'll help you.
After all these years, a helping hand? Oh, goddess, what guile is hidden here? I take no raft you grudge me out to sea. Or yield me first a great oath if I do, to work no more enchantment to my harm.
What a dog you are to think of such a thing! My witness then be earth and sky and dripping sticks that I swear by. I have no further spells to work against you. Come, Odysseus, my heart is not a piece of stone.
It's interesting in that scene to me with Odysseus to wonder, could he have escaped some other way? He certainly takes a long time to get away from some of these women. Are we meant to kind of think that he is only partially trying to get home?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a question. It is seriously a question that I continue to ask myself, that it's difficult to not think of his journey home without thinking of kind of the convenience of how he ends up getting home. I mean, yes, there is the trial of Troy, and there is the trial of Poseidon, and the trial of the Cyclops. But, you know, one of the ways that he manages to escape from Circe is by using sex as a currency, which he seems very willing to do in order to save his shipmates. So it's a very difficult thing to kind of wrap my mind around, and that's kind of the core challenge, is to make it clear, because at some point he does say in his story that while, you know, he did wash up on Calypso's island after, you know, a really horrible traumatic time trying to, you know, get out of the torrents and the waves and the storms, and was nursed, quote unquote, back to health, we could say, by Calypso. And he says that never in all of their liaisons did he give consent, and yet there were still liaisons. So yeah, it's by my standards, certainly, and I would assume that by the standards of our modern world, it's kind of a messy thing to wrap your mind around, that yes, it's 20 years of, you know, getting home to the quote-unquote real women.
Well, I think it just shows how he's a complicated hero.
He is a complicated hero, because even if you go back to the scene with the Cyclops, where he uses his wit and tricks him by having him think that, you know, the name of the person who injured him is nobody, then he goes ahead. Odysseus tells him, oh, you know, yeah, actually it's Odysseus. I did this to you. And had he not had that pride, had he not boasted, Poseidon would not have gotten angry at Odysseus.
And that I think, is, I mean, that's the challenge of every actor, is to, when you approach a character, is to be willing to set aside your preconceived notions, your biases, your own belief system in order to enter into another character who has a different life experience, who has different qualities. And, you know, it's the classic Greek hero, that there are all these things that we can boast about this character, and then there are all these other things that eventually lead to all of the turmoil that he goes through.
Yes. Let's take a look at another scene that stands out for me, and that's the Lotus Eaters. I had a student in my Odyssey project that I do who actually compared the Lotus Eaters to druggies in Chicago. But tell us about the Lotus Eaters and how that's going to be shown on stage.
Well, our Lotus Eaters actually are, this is one section of the show that is almost pure movement, which is one of the fantastic things about it. And I love the fact that you brought up the narcotic side of it, shall we say. I think that this is also one of these moments. I think it's apropos that we are doing this on a university campus where people themselves are on their own four-year journey to discover who it is that they are. And everybody will be faced with a myriad of temptations along the way.
Yes.
And it's either, you know, falling into those temptations and pulling yourself out, or being able to know who you are and stand up against them, that you really find your own self in this world. And this is one of the moments in the show that is purely done through movement. We have a little bit of a narrative that carries us in, but then we see this society of people that come on stage and loll about and
Well, I you know, from reading it, we were pretty inspired by, I think it's going to be a cross somewhat between the Cheshire Cat and Alice in Wonderland, and Busby Berkeley. So I think we're going to bring, you know, it has this sort of exotic, in fact, the music is kind of exotic, almost Indian inspired music, to create this kind of ambiance of, it's very sensual. It'll be, you know, a lot of blossoming in different ways. And, yeah, kind of the free love of the 60s, I suppose, 70s.
Let's hear a little of the music.
Mm-hmm.
That's very sort of enchanting, seductive sounding music. How does Odysseus survive the Lotus Eaters?
Well, he's the one that actually does stand firm in this particular instance. Many of his sailors go onto this land where, you know, men who consume this flower forget everything and often don't come back. And he goes in with one other man, and they pull these sailors who've been seduced into the arms of the Lotus Eaters out and away and drive them back to the ship wailing that they want to stay on this particular island. But it is actually Odysseus that has to go in and rescue his men, which is actually something he has to frequently do.
We're going to look at the sirens, where Odysseus has to put beeswax in his ears to survive them, when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I made straight for the ship and roused the men. They scrambled to their places by the rowlocks. We pulled away from Circe's island, but soon enough the wind fell, and a calm came over all the sea. Plug up your ears and tie me down. The sirens have begun.
We hear one note given on a pitch pipe, and then everything you do is so important. Oh, you big, big, sad, poor, tired, tired men. You big, sad, poor, tired, tired men. Oh, you big, big, sad, poor, tired, tired men. You big, sad, poor, tired, tired men.
That's a scene with the sirens from Mary Zimmerman's modern retelling of Homer's Odyssey. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with several members from the University Theater production of The Odyssey, which will open on Friday, November 7th in Madison. With me are Heather Pickering, director, Li Chao-Peng, choreographer, Kaylin Fleck, playing the part of Odysseus, and Christian Inouye, composer and actor. In that scene with the sirens, when I was reading the actual script, I suddenly realized, oh my, we're not in Homer anymore, because suddenly it's very feminist. It's starting to sound like Stepford Wives and Handmaid's Tale and something very different. Can you tell us, for one thing, with the sirens, where it says it's a nurse, a girl, a Girl Scout, a businesswoman, a teacher, a bride, and a nun, are you doing this direction where it says all clothed entirely in red?
Yes, we are, actually. This is one moment where the modern world absolutely crashes into this tale. In my world, I like to think that this is Mary Zimmerman's answer to the patriarchal society that is present within this piece. And it's kind of interesting, these modern day stereotypes that are now presented on stage almost kind of are a reminder the way we viewed women has not really changed that much over the centuries. But these women not only offer this seduction to the men, but these women are also offering knowledge, which is a little bit of a sidestep as well. And when these women appear, they are in all modern clothing. They're bringing in pieces of furniture we have not seen in the show up to this point. And we have a very specific place that we are pulling from movement-wise when we get to this place.
Yeah, I mean, the scene, you know, we very, very strongly hear her voice coming through loud and clear, I think, in this scene. And I think it's meant to be really jarring. It's meant to be jarring. So the choreography will be really a step in a new direction. And they're dancing with chairs.
You know? Okay. What I find interesting is that the sirens, I always had pictured them with sort of beautiful music that made the men have the ships crash on the rocks. But here it's saying all the things men want to hear. They go on to say, I love it when you ignore me. And, you know, you don't need to change anything. And yeah, all the things men want women to say, these sirens are saying. That's funny.
It's inflammatory. Yes. I mean, I think it's supposed to, you know, make us hear that and say, wait, that's not true, you know.
Yeah. And Heather, can you give us a example of one of these amazing lists. It's almost like we've opened a thesaurus
Right. One of the sirens actually is a teacher, and she opens the thesaurus on stage, and we learn the history of women. So one of her lists is Venus, nymph, wench, grisette, little bit of fluff, girl, etc., inamorata, love, etc., courtesan, etc., spinster, virgin, bachelor, girl, new woman, Amazon, see also girl, girl, noun, one, a young, unmarried female person. For example, hired a girl to babysit. Synonyms, damsel, gal, lass, lassie, maid, maiden, miss, missy, quail, quiff, wench, tomboy, deb, debutante, sub-deb, sub-debutante, bobby soxer, schoolgirl, gamine. Two, synonyms, see, maids. Two, three, synonyms, see, girlfriend.
And then the lovely way these sirens leave saying, oh, no, don't get up. I'll take care of it. The women that please. That is a real departure from Homer. And it was for me a fun part of reading the script. I look forward to seeing it on stage. There are also moving moments. And one that struck me is when Odysseus has been gone so long, and Telemachus, who's talked about wishing he had a father who just was a normal father and stayed at home, when they do finally reunite. And I'm wondering if we could hear a little bit of the conversation between the two of them.
Mm-hmm. Father, all my life your fame as a fighting man has echoed in my ears. But what you speak of is a staggering thing, beyond imagining. How can the two of us defeat a house full of men in their prime?
It's true. We only have two allies, but their names are Zeus and Athena. Here's your part. At daybreak, go on home. Go mingle with our princes. The swineherd later will bring me there, a beggar by my looks. If they make fun of me or injure me, do nothing. Let your ribs cage up your springing heart, no matter what I suffer. Then, at night, round up all our old weapons and armor. Leave them no arms in the great hall. Now, one more thing. If you are my son and blood, let no one hear I am about. Not my father Laertes, nor the swineherd here, nor Penelope herself.
And then the two of them exit together, a real father-son moment there. And mm-hmm. they have a secret plot that they can mm-hmm. have together. Mm-hmm. It's a great moment. We have only a few minutes left, but let me ask each of you, that's each of the four of you, can you just tell me a little bit about what you hope an audience would take away out of the theater if this production of Mary Zimmerman's Odyssey goes the way you want it to? What is the sort of takeaway message or thought or idea for you? Let's start with you, Heather.
I think the one thing that I hope people walk out of the theater thinking is, after sitting there watching this man go through 20 years of trials, he still manages to keep his eye on the target. And no matter what is thrown his way, he keeps going. No matter how hard it is, there is something that he's still keeping his eye on, working towards, trying to obtain and achieve, fighting against all odds. And I feel as if people will see many moments of their own life present in this particular story. And hopefully it'll be something that'll be empowering. Like, I can keep going. I can move forward. I can get that which I want to get. And sometimes you do have to get broken down into tiny pieces so that you can be put back together to become the person you need to be in the future.
Kalen, Mr. Odysseus.
Kind of going along with what Heather said, I think it really just comes down to the love of a family and how that love kind of heals the separation, heals the wounds of the separation, and whatever wounds come from that separation. I'd be interested in having kind of a bird's eye view of the conversation that Penelope and Odysseus have after they've been reunited and they've kind of come back together, and she then begins asking him the question, what?
You did what with
you
who?
You did what? And, you know, I by no means condone his
philandering.
You know, what his philandering, but that, you know, the complexity of these characters, the complexity, the highs and the lows that they've gone through, and that this family comes back together and they are healed through their love of each other.
Great. Li Xiaoping, choreographer, what do you want people to take away from the theater from your standpoint?
Well, what I take away from the story is that, you know, going through life, we all make choices. We are faced with a lot of choices. And sometimes we make the wrong choice. And then we have to live with that mistake, you know, the consequences of those choices. And to make amends, whatever it is, and then, you know, it's not the end of your life. You can keep going, make another choice. Hopefully that'll get you in the right direction towards home.
Kind of like when your GPS system redirects and recalculates. And
yeah. So, you know, our lives are journeys as well. And we don't really know how it's going to end up. And we probably won't, you know, no matter how good of a mapper you are, some of your plans, the best plans, don't actually follow through exactly in that way.
And Christian, as composer, as actor, when will it be a success for you if the audience does what?
Oh, my. If they can notice the theme throughout that I've written, the musical themes, that's the joke. But really, I think there's a lot of really great moments in the show where Odysseus is reflecting on what has happened in the past for him. And by understanding that, he can then move forward and make the rest of the story complete and really succeed. So if there's anything, I hope the audience can do that and say, what has happened to me in the past? How can I learn from that and move forward and succeed?
And certainly it's a tale that illustrates the power of storytelling itself. Story after story makes that clear. Thank you to all of you for being with us for University of the Air.
Thank you so very much.
And break a leg. I'm Emily Auerbach, and hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.